Yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
Big blue skulls, purple shawls, big blue bulls, big blue bulls, let's make little blue evil.
Welcome to Farce Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
I'm Pete.
I'm Ben. And welcome to The Henson Perspective, where we talk about an episode of The Muppet Show, 45 years after its original U.S. air date. And today, we're talking about the 17th production episode of Season 2, guest starring Julie Andrews, which aired in New York City on February 20th, 1978, almost a full 2 months after it first aired in the U.K. This episode was originally produced between November 23rd and 25th of 1977, and it stars a veteran of stage and screen, and perhaps the best actor that they've had on the show so far. In terms of not her film performances, but her commitment to interacting with the Muppets like they're real. And yes, to being on the show like she's a real person. She has almost no artifice. There are some lines that she delivers where she can't quite make the dialogue seem natural.
Yeah.
But by and large, when she says or does something, she just seems like an actual human being captured on camera.
It's uncanny how natural this felt.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll get into this shortly in the trivia, but she's worked with Muppets before, as she mentions in this episode.
Yep.
So it's not like other guest stars who are like, this is weird. She's very used to performing with arms and men looking down at monitors and not at her. So
she has had the advantage of being prepped for this kind of scenario.
And also, not that I've ever seen Mary Poppins, but I'm pretty sure that's half animated and half...
Not half animated.
No? All right.
The most of the animation that interacts with the live-action characters is in one or two musical numbers,
okay,
as opposed to throughout the entire film. It's not Roger Rabbit.
All I was trying to get at is...
It's not Don Knotts and the Incredible Mr. Limpet.
All I was trying to get at was... You don't have a third one? Okay. All I was trying to get at was the idea that maybe she's also worked with things that weren't there in the past as well.
It's not Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers.
There it is. I figured Space Jam was the easier pull, but...
I've never seen Space Jam.
Don't think you've seen it to pull it.
I wasn't actually prepared to do a whole run of them, so... she was very natural.
Yes.
Right from the beginning. But speaking of the beginning, shall we just talk about the episode in order, or is there anything that we need to prepare ourselves for before we get into it?
I think there's enough intertwining things that it makes sense to go in order, so why don't we go into trivia first?
So that we can actually talk about the episode.
Exactly. So Ben, I have prepared 5 questions for you about our guest star, Julie Andrews.
Fire away.
Question 1. Before she got her big break as a stage performer, Julie Andrews was at one time the youngest solo performer in a Royal Variety performance. On November 1st, 1948, a then 13-year-old Julie Andrews sang for King George VI and Queen Elizabeth. But which future Muppet Show guest star also performed that night? A. Danny Kaye, B. Liberace, or C. Wally Bode?
I'm going to say Wally Bode.
No. Wally Bode did not perform that night, but okay, he did work with Julie Andrews the year before.
Mm.
The two of them were part of a musical revue called Starlight Roof, and her part of the show was he would be on stage doing balloon animals in his comedy act, and he would then ask for an audience participant who wants a balloon animal.
And 13-year-old Julie Andrews,
Plant in the audience, would raise her hand and then come on stage and go, "Well, I sing too," and they go, "Oh, why don't you give us a little number?" And she'd blow the audiences away.
Who was it actually then?
Danny Kaye. Hmm. Question 2. Julie Andrews had her own variety show that aired for 24 episodes between 1972 and 1973. On February 17th, 1973, an episode aired, and which one of the following things did not happen on that episode? A. Jim Henson appeared as himself on a discussion panel with future Muppet Show guest stars Julie Andrews, Sandy Duncan, and Paul Williams. B. Julie Andrews performed Oh Babe, What Would You Say with Thog, who later performed the same act with Kay Ballard in season one. Or C, Jim Henson met producer Lou Grade on the set, who later became a producer on The Muppet Show.
D.
That act did in fact happen. The somewhat falsity was A. Jim Henson did appear on a discussion panel, but Paul Williams was not on it. An Italian tenor named Sergio Franchi appeared with Julie Andrews, Sandy Duncan, and Jim Henson. But yes, this is where Jim Henson met Lou Grade, and so this show largely exists because of this show with Julie Andrews. Question number three. Julie Andrews owns a chalet in Gstaad, Switzerland.
I'm pretty sure you don't pronounce the G in Gstaad.
Fair. Every year, she does what in Gstaad? A. Until 1997, she opened the New Year Music Festival of Gstaad with a performance of The Hills Are Alive. But because of her botched vocal cord surgery in 1998, she now serves as the Master of Ceremonies. B. She hosts one of the locations for the annual Gstaad Promenade Parties, a town-wide cocktail party where businesses and homes open their doors to the public for drinks and socialization. Or C, she pays for the entire town's Christmas lights.
Tempted to go with number three just because that would be the odd question about Gstaad.
Well then, we'll see if you fall for my charade.
Two.
You should have gone with your gut. She pays for the entire town's Christmas lights. And while Gstaad does have a New Year music festival, also the annual Gstaad Promenade Party is a thing, but I kind of made up what it is because I could find no information other than it was listed on their
website. Oh, so you're saying that your data was flawed about the Gstaad Promenade? My God!
Ben, if you make one more, they might cancel this pod. Also, the best I found was the New Year Music Festival started in, like, 2012. Question number four. Julie Andrews is another one of our close but not quite EGOT guest stars. She has won 2 Emmys, 3 Grammys, and 1 Oscar. But despite getting her start in theater, she's never won a Tony. She has been nominated for 3 and was widely considered to be the frontrunner for 1 in 1996. But she lost to which coincidental competition? A. The revival of The King and I, which she performed a song from in this episode. B. The revival of My Fair Lady, which gave her her first major notice, but in the film, Audrey Hepburn was cast as her role of Eliza Doolittle. But that casting is what allowed her to take the role of Maria
in Sound of Music.
Which she then beat Audrey for Best Actress. They're both nominated, but Julie Andrews won. Or C, the revival of The Sound of Music, for which she won her first Academy Award.
B.
Unfortunately, A. The My Fair Lady revival, I believe, was 1997 or 98. So it was very close to it, but not quite there. But yes, The King and I won Best Musical that year. She was the only person nominated for Victor Victoria. And out of solidarity with the rest of the overlooked cast and crew, she withdrew her nomination because she was so upset that
nobody else was recognized in the performance.
Yeah. An issue of Playbill magazine said that she was still technically eligible. She just basically told people, don't vote for me, I don't want this. But when the nomination was announced, everyone was like, oh, it's hers. So her selflessness prevented her from becoming an EGOT winner. Question number 5. I mentioned it in an earlier answer, but she famously underwent vocal cord surgery in 1997 and it ruined her singing voice. She had a soprano 4-octave range, which was the same octave range as Freddie Mercury. And after many reconstructive surgeries, her speaking voice has gotten better, but her singing voice is forever altered. In an article from Limelight magazine in 2013, it says, her famous 4-octave soprano was then released to a fragile alto. She was quoted at the time as saying, I can sing the hell out of Old Man River. But this hasn't stopped her from doing voiceover work. And which of the following is not one of her recent voiceover credits? A. The voice of Carathan, a Leviathan in James Wan's Aquaman. B. The voice of Gru's mother in the Despicable Me franchise. Or C. The voice of Lady Danbury in Bridgerton.
C.
Correct. You didn't fall for my dirty trick, because she is in all 3, but she's not the voice of Lady Danbury. She's the voice of Lady Whistledown in Bridgerton.
Bridgerton's not animated.
Yeah, no.
She just appears off screen.
She's basically the gossip girl of the show.
Oh.
She voices, I don't know, I've also never seen it, but she voices some gossiper who's always talking about what's going on in town or something.
I just knew the other two were true.
So yeah, she has had a long career, as evidenced by she performed for the Queen at 13 in 1948, and she's in Bridgerton currently.
Yeah, the fact that she, I think her first either West End or Broadway role was at 19.
Yeah, it was, I think, 55.
It means that she has been established as an incredibly, you know, knock the doors off the back walls of the theater voice for such an extraordinary amount of time that she really has had the opportunity to do many different things over time, so much so that a lot of people aren't necessarily aware of the weird vagaries of her career, and then missed Victor Victoria and missed her more experimental things, a lot of which she did with her husband, Blake Edwards, where she was able to, and this is has no insight into her personality or her choices, but it feels like it gave her the opportunity to play with her career and her reputation for a while, and yet it never really stuck. People have always thought of her as the person from her early work, and nothing she's done has really shaken that image.
Yeah, in researching, she's kind of a dirty woman. Not all, I mean, I don't remember the exact quote, but apparently she got together with her second husband, Blake Edwards, because he was asked about her at some point, and he kind of brushed her off and said, oh, Julie Andrews, I bet she has roses for lady parts, or some sort of flower. And she heard this and apparently sent him those flowers, and that's what got them talking, and then they fell in love and got married. And she's also said lots and lots of
off-color,
yes, things about Mary Poppins and her other roles that people think are so prim and proper. And she's like, no. I envision these characters as being fully real people. And so that also shocked me, because she doesn't have really any of those moments in this episode. She is funny.
Well, there's no reason why she should.
Well, no, but it was a whole different side of her that I had no idea existed before reading it. Because I've also had that impression that, oh, she's The Sound of Music. She's Mary Poppins. She did that weird movie with her husband, but that was weird and
maybe a one-off, as opposed to who she really is.
Yeah, or her trying to do something and then it not being successful, so she went back to being that.
But I think it is true that audiences don't want that side of her by and large. I think there's actually an enormous amount of footage and films where she shows her range and ability. It's just that nobody keeps those aspects of her in their memory. They revert back to the easy cliche of she is the person that institutes rules and order. Not to mention that the very idea of Maria von Trapp is that she's a 19 to 24-year-old woman who runs away from a convent and seduces a baron who's engaged to be married. Like, she goes into that house as the nanny and is the stereotypical, the man is having an affair with his governess. And nobody talks about that aspect of that story, because in part, it's based on a real-life family that escaped the Nazis. And so they're thought of as wonderful and pure and heroic. And nobody really pays attention to the fact that, hey, she's a bit of a homewrecker.
Another interesting thing was I was reading these specials in the early 70s, where she met the Muppets, followed a bit of a downfall in her career, because she was in Mary Poppins in 1965. She met her husband in the late 60s, or her second husband, Blake Edwards, and did two movies with him that bombed. And she kind of didn't do movies for a little while. And I feel like TV welcomed her with open arms, which as
to do variety work, to do that charming musical stuff that she was known for.
Exactly. And she kind of rebuilt her reputation from that. And then, well, that's not entirely true, because there's so much to talk about with Julie Andrews. And we only have four moments with her in this episode. So we can move on into the episode, but she is all over the place.
Well, let's start with her first moment in the dressing room after Scooter comes in to say that it's 15 seconds to curtain.
Yet again, 15 seconds.
This is the closest we've had so far to the equivalent of thank you 15.
Yes. Yeah, because she acknowledges, I'll be ready.
She says, thank you, I'll be ready. She doesn't call out a recognition of how much time she has, but it's very theatrical. Mm-hmm. And what she's doing is theatrical, and not in the sense of what she's doing is broad and overdramatic, but she's just straightening her hair, getting herself picture-perfect ready in a mirror, and she is entirely focused on the mirror, and she says,
thank you. Thank you. I'll be ready. I'll be ready just so long as nobody else drops in.
With absolute sincerity of this is a person who's getting ready to go on stage. She's doing business, and there's absolutely nothing disingenuous about what she's doing until Muppets start falling from the ceiling.
Yeah, it's so funny.
Yeah.
She does not get hit by any, so there's no hits here.
You have two or three empty, fluffy bodies fall behind her, and then a giant purple furry worm thing that I've never seen before, monster, mm-hmm. comes up from the right side of her. It doesn't really mesh to the idea of these are things that have fallen and are now gathering around her, because they come up from positions that aren't in sync with where the bodies fell.
Yeah.
At the same time,
I do think they do a pretty good job of dropping the right colors, though.
Yes.
It might not be the right shape, but there's definitely a blue one. There's definitely a couple purple ones. There's a pink one.
You've got the green Frackle, the blue Frackle, Shaky Sanchez, and Big Mean Mama. But you also have three previously unidentified monster Muppets, one of which is played by, I believe, Frank, that starts whooping up a storm right before it cuts to Kermit in the O.
Mm-hmm. This made me laugh both times. Kermit seems especially happy to announce Julie Andrews.
And I think this is a re-record because it doesn't match up with Kermit at all.
There is definitely a re-record later in this episode.
Interesting. Yeah, I feel like the mouth sync on this is wrong. So I think they decided they needed to be more pumped for Julie Andrews. And went back in and did a much more enthusiastic voiceover.
So you don't necessarily mean a reuse, mm-hmm. but they...
I think they did it, and then they were like, we need more energy here.
Yeah,
and
she's a good enough friend. We can't just go, guest starring Julie Andrews! Yeah. We need pumped. I can see that. Statler Waldorf whistle the song, which I love, because I've said before, I like it when they're in rhythm.
So even though they're a little off tune and it's sort of weaker because they're going as opposed to humming along with it.
Yep. Well, I mean, that's a theme of this episode is bad whistling.
I look forward to further expounding on that.
And then Gonzo has lights on his trumpet that as he blows, the house lights dim down and those lights light up.
And it doesn't really work.
Nope.
And yet the laugh track is wild for this. They are attempting, in my opinion, to paste over the fact that this gag is limp.
I think this is possibly doesn't work as well because of the technology of the 70s. Because when he's moving that trumpet around, those lights are tailing. Mm-hmm. They are like you're waving a sparkler in the middle of the night on a 4th of July, like trying to draw things because they're just all over the place.
We go to curtain. Kermit says these are very excited because our special guest star is a very talented lady and good friend. This is the first major indication that will be confirmed by dialogue later, that there's a pre-existing relationship between mm-hmm. these two. And then we go to opening number with the guest star, which three episodes ago you said, that's very weird that they do that. And now we've had three in a row mm-hmm. that have started off with the guest star being the opening bit. We get the entirety of Lonely Goat Herd from Sound of Music being done. There might be one or two lines missing, but this feels like more of a full rendition of a song than we normally get mm-hmm. from our musical numbers. Less first verse, chorus, half a second verse or a bridge, chorus and out.
Mm-hmm.
There is a... indulgent is the wrong word, but there's a respectful amount of commitment to the song.
Yeah, I don't know how long the original one is. This one was 2.85 minutes, which feels short.
Yeah, because this drags a little.
Yep.
Because the basic comic premise of this is that they have the goat herd be a goat, and they have the various Muppet performers play the roles of the people in the song that she's describing. Apparently, originally in the 1959 stage version, this song was performed by Maria to the kids. But that when Ernest Lehman rewrote the script for the film, that it was moved to a performance where the kids did a puppet show version of this for Baron Von Trapp under Maria's guidance. And so that this was kind of, in the film version, a spectacle of lots of puppets and things and performing the whole thing, as opposed to it just being a vocal narrative. So there is some form here of doing interpretations of the song where everybody does a thing. But you know what's interesting about all the various parts in this song?
Do tell.
I don't think Frank Oz is any of them.
True. Nope.
Because we have a girl pig playing the one little girl in a pale pink coat. Annie Sue Pig,
yep,
as played by Louise Gold, who is also her mom, and who is also the strange floppy dog that you identified last week as part of the songs from the past. Some sort of hound?
I believe so.
You don't remember what kind of hound? You were so mad at me that I didn't get what kind of hound it was, and now you're like, whatever, I don't remember that. That's in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, Afghan hound. Yep, there it is. I just needed a look.
So we've got Louise Gold doing triple duty.
Yep.
We've got three pigs, three chickens, four dogs, Miss Mousy. It should be all hands on deck, but there's no Frank.
I think that's because... So, we both said somewhat disparaging things about the song itself.
Mm.
The number itself is insanely...
complicated.
Complicated and detailed and good. While I hate the song...
You go straight to the word hate.
Yeah.
Very quickly.
Because I don't like it. And the first watch, I was like, this is boring. I hate this. But on the second watch, I kind of shut off my ears and just watched what was happening.
Yeah.
And it's so elaborate. And there's so many setups that I think that's why, like, you had the hill set, you had the picnic table set, you had the house set.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easy to do double or triple duty on this because...
because there's only one major shot where you have pretty much everybody in shot. For the final yodels, you've got an angle on the castle,
mm-hmm,
that has Kermit in the window, the female pig up above him, and then you've got the porch with a couple of the dogs and Gonzo and the goat and Annie Sue Pig in front.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically everybody in shot at the same time. Everything else, you've got people switching between puppets in order to fill out the scene for that one verse.
Yep.
But yeah, there's, as you say, there's lots of opportunities for people to double and triple up because of the way the scene is shot.
Is Fozzie in this?
No, Fozzie's not in Lonely Goat.
Okay.
I was thinking about that. Is it possible that Julie and Frank's schedule didn't match up at all? And the answer is no, because Fozzie's in that later sketch.
Yeah.
So we actually get a fairly small amount of Frank overall. The only piggy we get is in the dance sequence, mm-hmm, with Gonzo. Obviously...
Frank is also one of the Zucchini Brothers.
Yes, he is.
Yeah.
So you get Zucchini Brothers, you get the monster at the beginning, you get Piggy, and you get Fozzie. So he's more there than you might realize at first blush. And he's in plenty of scenes with Julie.
Mm-hmm. Maybe he was just unavailable for that day, because again, this is so elaborate that this was probably an entire day of filming.
Yeah, almost certainly. Hey Pete, who directed this episode?
Peter Harris.
I mentioned that only because, speaking of the Afghan hound,
mm-hmm,
there is a lyric where she is the primary vocalist and she's not on camera until the camera pans back to include her. And so it's one of those things where there's a voice and you don't know where it's coming from until Harris finally gets his act together and shows us.
So I watched, not quite, but we'll just go with it, my first thing on TikTok this week.
Okay.
Because in my Google News feed, there was something about video of a table read from a Muppet show.
Oh.
And I was like, ooh, I gotta click on this. And then it linked to two different TikToks, which I think were just clips from special features of things that are on the DVD.
Okay.
But it was, oh, I forget which guest star now. They were showing the making of the in the Navy sketch.
Oh, okay.
And they filmed the table read, then they filmed the making of that and showed, you know, full body people, the set, how it moves. They even have footage of control room. I don't remember whether it was Peter or Philip Kasson directing this episode, but both were called out by name in the video. Mm-hmm. And you get footage of one of them going, okay, camera two, go. And someone else calling out, like the first AD calling out the action for the boat and things. It was really neat.
Was there any footage of in the Navy in its final form in somewhere in that montage?
Yes.
Because I recently saw a clip of that, and I assumed it might be in your top five of worst green screen on The Muppet Show.
Oh.
Because the way in which they superimpose the fake water around the
boat. Oh, yeah.
Is what I would call not good, and I was waiting for us to get to that.
No, we can talk more about that when we actually cover that moment.
But absolutely.
Because it came up naturally, I was like, okay, I can mention this now. I was not going to mention it originally.
Do we have anything else to talk about from Lonely Goatherd?
I mean, so you and I didn't love the song, but we appreciated the thing. Stanley Waldorf loved this sketch.
Did they love the whole sketch, or is it, as it revealed, it's that Waldorf really loved the goat?
Yeah, it's true. He would love that old goat.
That's what Statler says. And Statler says he would that old goat directly to camera.
Yep, but Waldorf does say hooray and bravo. We then go backstage, which shows Kermit coming directly from offstage, mm-hmm. still in outfit, complimenting the number he was just in.
Well, complimenting all of, as we just said, the lots and lots of performers. The two pigs with brush on their back, the four dogs, the three chickens, the partridge in a pear tree, all of them. Or in this case, he says, good job, pigs and chickens, and then a cow moos, and he says,
way to go, cow! Yes, that's a real cow, all right.
And then stops for a moment, realizing what he just saw.
Because this is not a Muppet cow. No. This is not Clarabelle. This is not the cow that we've pointed out that was in the Twiggy sketch and a couple of others. This is a live actual cow backstage at the Muppet Show. And this is basically what Kermit also says. He says, that's a real cow. Which is philosophically fascinating.
That's a good point.
Kermit would, I think, say, I'm a frog. He wouldn't say, I'm not a real frog.
No.
But here in this line, he says, that's a real cow.
Yeah.
Now, have you seen, speaking of background footage, I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. Have you seen the camera test that was done by director Howley for the Muppet movie?
No, I've not seen it, but I know about it.
So the point of this camera test was, when I brought this up, I think, when we were talking about the chickens and interacting with real animals. And I said that it was done with them interacting in real environments. And that's what they wanted to check. They wanted to see, what did the Muppets look like in nature? What did they look like in real light?
Yep.
And I don't know if I'm going to clip this or not for the episode, but for Pete right now, I'm going to have Fozzie and Kermit talking, and the things that they're talking about as Frank and Jim riff is this same idea of what is real.
Mm.
It's a great looking tree. Yeah, look at that bark. Feel that. That's real bark. That's real tree. Right to the idea, huh? Yep. A bear in his natural habitat.
Yeah, well, but Fozzie... See, the thing of it is, though, you're not a real, you're not a real bear. I mean, you're not a real natural bear.
What?
Well, I mean, you're talking about a bear in his natural habitat.
Yeah.
Well,
me, in my natural...
The cows back there.
Yeah.
Now, those are real cows.
I think I can also see Jim in the corner there.
But I bring this up specifically because it's unscripted, but I think it's got dialogue in there that is them remembering this interaction.
Yeah.
Because as Kermit says, those are real cows over there. Just like in this, he says, that's a real cow.
Yeah, that's wild. Because it's almost like, I mean, I guess maybe Julie Andrews is a real fish.
We'll get to that sketch eventually. I wasn't able to research it in order to give you the possibility of being able to refer to those segments. So there's some aspects of those lyrics that I'm unfamiliar with. So I'm hoping you might be able to help me out with understanding parts of them.
No, probably not.
Well, good. I'm glad I was blocked. At the end of this sketch, well, so there's a line where Kermit says, I think they're going to love this show in Jersey.
Yeah. Is that a British Jersey reference? Is that a New Jersey reference?
Well, what I think is fantastic about the writing of that line is that it gets to be both.
Yeah.
Just to let you know, Jersey is an island between the south coast of England and the Normandy region of France, and it is famous for its dairy cows.
Okay.
And a Jersey cow, like a Guernsey cow, are both bred, since they live on islands, to be small. And are well regarded because they're able to produce wild amounts of milk in comparison to their size. And New Jersey, the Garden State, is one of its major exports, continues to be fruit. They have cranberry bogs, but they also produce strawberries and raspberries and various other fruits. But they used to be a huge dairy producer. And in the mid-1900s, there were over 500 dairy farms in the state of New Jersey.
It is the Garden State, yes, as you
and
said.
And so it is a well-tooled joke in being able to work with both the U.S. and U.K. audiences with equal topicality.
Hmm.
But before we get to that final closing of the bit, I just wanted to bring that up now in order to say, I suspect this is a Jersey cow.
Yeah.
For it to be small enough that you can have the Muppets interact with it and have it not seem enormous, but also to fit on set.
Yeah.
I suspect strongly that this is, in fact, a Jersey cow and that that worked its way into the dialogue and that joke. Upon discovering this strange real cow, Kermit does what he always does in elements of backstage panic as bellow for Scooter.
Yep. He's panicked about a cow, so he wants his gopher. Scooter has no idea where this cow came from either.
He says it must have sneaked in. There's a very strange joke here, which is he says cows don't sneak, snakes sneak, which I think is just them enjoying that wordplay.
I think so as well.
And Kermit tells Scooter to find out to whom the cow belongs, and Scooter does this by asking the cow.
Scooter then runs away, and then Kermit makes the Jersey joke.
We talked about in the episode with the filmed live chickens how hard it must have been to get good footage, because some of those segments are really short, that like they must have been desperate to edit those into shape. And this feels almost the opposite.
Yeah, this was the laziest, most patient cow of all time.
But also the way in which the director allows there to be solid beats of nothing happening except puppets standing next to a real organism, and just the weird dissonance of that, the strange uncanny valley-ness of it is what is part of the joke. And so Scooter goes over to the cow and just takes a moment before saying,
find out who it belongs to.
Okay. Who do you belong to?
And that in and of itself is funny. It helps land the punchline, but it's also just, it's nice that it has a moment to breathe, and it helps accentuate the weirdness of the situation.
Yeah, it especially helps accentuate it because in most backstage segments, there's not different camera angles. The camera might pan left or pan right, but this is a totally different angle than we've seen backstage before.
In order to have the puppet next to the cow.
Yep, and get the cow's face directly at camera.
And he shoots the cow appearing to look directly at the Muppets with those weird black wall-eyed cow eyes. So you don't, I would say, I don't have any clear indication as to where the cow is looking, but it seems it is effectively photographed so that whenever the Muppets are interacting with the cow, it feels like the cow is sort of going, really? In relationship to whichever Muppet is talking to it.
Yeah, it's being a very, very good straight cow.
After that, we cut to a Muppet news flash, where the Muppet newsman says that a plane carrying a load of sports equipment was forced to jettison its cargo, dropping over 10,000 ping pong balls, at which point...
Maybe 100?
I mean, I appreciate the economy of production scale, that getting more than 100 ping pong balls, considering that we already used 3 last week in the Swedish Chef sketch, to drop on the counter, and then he says, and one bowling ball, at which point it falls on his head perfectly, and he falls down on the desk, and then you get the newsman wipe as we cut back to Kermit.
I counted two ping pong balls also hitting him on the head. I watched it maybe 10 times trying to go frame by frame. And I was really only able to see bounce off trajectories. Mm. I wasn't able to see any direct hits. So I might be off on this one, but I'm guessing 3 hits total in this sketch.
Pete, yes. I'm very glad that you were counting hits,
mm-hmm.
but I think our audience has come to expect a different kind of calculation when it comes to things falling from a great height.
Yep, I did not do that because we know the rough height of planes.
30,000 feet.
Yeah, so I didn't really need to do the math on this one.
Not even to point out the fact that if you're going to drop 100,000 ping pong balls, every single one of those would be a lethal weapon by the time it hit the ground. Just to calculate the absolute scary terminal velocity with which those would be hitting the desk. Well, and the idea that...
ping pong balls are still very light.
And that...
this isn't a perfect vacuum.
The bowling ball, which they said, and one bowling ball, as if it was dropped second, fell in the exact same space, whereas a plane going how many hundreds of miles per hour, if they dropped it even a second after they dropped all the ping pong balls, would have been miles further on instead of in the same studio.
You're dead on right that a bowling ball would have a much faster terminal velocity than the ping pong balls would. So
if they dropped it
at the same time and it was able to fall in the exact same location, the bowling ball should have landed first. Because wind resistance would have taken those ping pong balls all over the place.
Which is why there are only 100.
True. Yes, very true. Yeah.
It is timing-wise hilarious and fundamentally anathema to physics.
Which makes sense because the Muppet Theater is a Real House of Leaves situation.
As mentioned, Kermit then gets in front of the curtain to introduce another act, and in this case, it's the Great Gonzo.
Now, Ben, I mentioned earlier that something in this episode was redone.
Okay.
This introduction is a redub from the Teresa Brewer introduction of Kermit introducing Gonzo.
So this is the same footage, but with a different voiceover?
Yes. So if you watch carefully, you can tell that this lip sync does not match.
Mm. But that's fascinating because I did say that back with the Teresa Brewer episode, I talked about how that patter that they use at the beginning.
Ladies and gentlemen, in a major feat of death-defying music robotics never seen before.
Like, it has that cadence. This is slightly different, but it is the same basic rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
And so now that makes perfect sense.
Even though this is 217 and that was 222, that was filmed back in July.
We mentioned that with Teresa Brewer, that she was, her episode number makes no sense with her production dates.
Yep. And so this still leads to that mystery that in November they just reused footage from that episode.
Well, we'll get back to the weirdness of production dates later in our conversation.
Ooh, interesting.
The Great Gonzo is performing Eine Kleine Nachtmusik on the bagpipes on a flagpole 10 feet in the air. Pete, Ludwig van Beethoven composed Eine Kleine Nachtmusik.
Mm-hmm.
Previously in an episode, we talked about the oldest classical music.
Yes.
Do you have a wager as to whether or not this is the oldest compared to the ones that we talked about previously during the Sam Classy episode?
I think that is still older than this.
The oldest song is not this, that's correct, because this was composed in 1787. And he is performing it on bagpipes, and he's up against a starry black background, which therefore allows Dave Goles to be in black against the background, and therefore invisibly, puppeteering Gonzo, despite the fact that he's probably standing right there.
It didn't even dawn on me once to try and look for it. So that means they've gotten that much better at hiding themselves.
Yeah.
Also, Gonzo's full-bodied, so obviously this is great.
I just love the fact that he's full-bodied and it didn't occur to you to try and figure out how.
Yeah.
He's becoming more real to you all the time.
Yeah. It could also be that this sketch is great and very entertaining to watch, so I never even considered being like, what else is happening?
As he starts to play the song on the bagpipes, it cuts to the aforementioned beaver, mm-hmm. which is at the bottom of the flagpole, and he begins to start chewing through the flagpole.
It just dawned on me now as we started discussing this. He shouldn't have been playing Ina Kleina Nock music.
Because?
He should have been playing the song from the late 90s, Flagpole Sitta. And then he should have known the lyrics of the chorus being paranoia, paranoia, everybody's coming to get him. Because this beaver was out to get him.
Or, since that was in the 90s and this is from 1977, what? So it aired in 1978,
huh?
Is Flagpole Sitta a homage to this episode?
Very well could be. It certainly wouldn't be to people who used to actually flit on sagpoles.
Sit on flagpoles.
No, I'm going to stick with flit on sagpoles.
Fit on sagpoles. Ugh, the Screen Actors Guild always putting their people up on poles.
I'm an afterman myself.
Well, after that happens, it cuts back to Gonzo on the pole, his eyes bulging but continuing to play, which then allows them to cut back to the beaver having made more progress. This is the good version of the stuff that they did with the haircut from the messy guy,
yes.
where they would cut to Statler and Waldorf in the booth commenting on it. To cut between the suspense of Gonzo on the pole and the beaver cutting, it allows them to do a time lapse, an unrealistic time lapse, but a successful one.
Yeah.
They finally figured out their own formula.
Yeah, and it's wonderful. And then flagpole comes crashing down.
The beaver takes a bow.
Yeah. And then Statler and Waldorf, we cut to them, and Waldorf says Gonzo should quit while he's ahead.
And Statler says Gonzo should quit while he's alive.
It's a good note. He absolutely should. We then go backstage, and the beaver and Gonzo enter with the beaver snickering.
Beaver's justifiably proud at having destroyed art.
Kermit is a good stage manager in this moment, asking his performer if he's okay because he just fell 11 feet.
Kermit is just worried about workman's comp.
Yeah, probably. But Gonzo says he's fine, he just fell 11 feet onto solid concrete. Now, Ben,
yeah,
where is there concrete in this area? Because the stage is wood. We've established that. People have fallen through it many, many times.
The last time we had the stage being made out of wood, maybe they just poured concrete in order to repair it. Instead of putting boards back and having it continue to be, they just were like, let's fill that bad boy up with something solid.
Seems like that would be too expensive for J.P. Gross. I don't think he'd put that kind of money into it.
Depends on how many mob ties he has and how many people they needed to hide.
That's a good point. So.
But yes, this seems much more like Kermit being a bad stage manager because he admits that their security's been pretty lax because he doesn't know how that beaver got on stage.
Just like he doesn't know how the cow got backstage.
At which point Gonzo notices the cow.
Yep.
And is incredibly interested and attracted to this cow. Now, this is what I've been leading up to in conversation for a long time, where I talked about the idea that Gonzo being attracted to chickens was something that hadn't quite been solidified. We did have Gonzo and the live-action chickens in episode 204,
mm-hmm.
and that's where he interacted with Lolita the chicken. And you have previously said, well, you know, Gonzo and Camilla.
Camilla, right? Yeah.
But that hadn't quite been really established. And this is really the episode where both Gonzo and chickens and Gonzo and livestock gets doubly established.
Mm-hmm.
Because here we first have him, before we have any chicken references, just being really excited to be with this cow. And because of the production and airing order, it makes it seem like he's just interested in live animals because he was interested in Lolita the chicken. But he was also interested in the cheese. Like, and in Miss Piggy. He just
falls in love with his stage partners.
I think so, yes.
But he's not a stage partner to this cow.
No. But he is interested in whether or not she wants to be in show business.
That's a good point.
So he is interested in having her as a stage partner and a romantic partner simultaneously.
Ben, he wants to get this animal on the casting couch.
I was wondering what you were building up to and I should have seen it coming. So I could have ended this podcast before he said that.
I wonder if it's a leather casting couch.
Rude, Pete. As rude as Gonzo will be later.
But yeah, also, as we can mention it now and talk about it later, but this episode is also wildly all over the place with Gonzo's relationship status.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In terms of, is he available? Who's he interested in? How does that work?
Yeah.
I mentioned the chicken episode. In that episode, I talked about the chapter in Joseph Bailey's Memoirs of a Muppet Writer, mm-hmm. where he talked about the origin of that sketch. And one of the things that he said was Don Hinckley had written the cow stuff.
Okay.
And so much of the dialogue and the backstage cow segments comes out of his script and his work. And it came about because Jim specifically requested writing live animals into the show. But what I said at the time, and I want to reinforce now, is according to...
Reinforce cow?
According to Bailey, quote, "The cow episode was so successful that Jim decided he wanted a show with live chickens."
Interesting.
"Since Don had written the cow show and Jerry Jewell was the head writer with much more important things to do, the chicken routine fell to yours truly." So, an episode that we saw in production number 4 airs first and is produced first, but Bailey claims came about because the cow bit had been so successful.
Mm.
So this, which was produced in November, whereas the previous episode was produced on June 14th, is the previous work.
Now, you just showed me that clip of the live action
yep.
out in the wild.
From 1979.
All right. There we go.
Well, I will come back to the idea of this being thought of by Bailey as being built on work that was produced earlier, despite the fact that the production diaries and the fandom page listed as being produced later.
It could just be that only the Julie Andrews parts were November 22nd through 25th.
And that they had some of the other stuff done earlier.
Mm-hmm.
There's some credence to that. That we'll get back to.
Okay. I think I know what it is, knowing what the rest of this episode is, but I'll let you get to it later.
But just to point out, I think it seems like, to a degree, there were scripts written and mm-hmm. built and established before the stars had the ability to film, which makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
That they weren't finalizing all of the scripts specifically when the guests showed up for their 3 days of recording and production work.
Yeah.
That they had some stuff as locked as possible beforehand so that they knew what their production resources were, so that they knew how much time they needed with the guest, whether they had 12 out of the 14 episodes done and dusted before any guests showed up. I doubt, but at the same time, they weren't writing them week to week, I think is what is clear from this.
Absolutely. When Gonzo notices the cow,
mm-hmm.
he compliments her on her great pair of legs. In fact, she's got two great pairs of legs.
And we have another moment of Gonzo basically interacting with a silent cow,
mm-hmm.
but having great timing and energy. Goals does a fantastic job of building on that silence and having Gonzo respond to it appropriately with really good timing. And the shot is locked off in such a way that you're just watching the cow watch Gonzo, apparently. And Goals' work with that silent, implacable stage partner is really good.
Yeah. He then asks if the cow will at least go to dinner with him. And then Kermit shoots Gonzo away as Scooter enters and updates him that nobody else knows anything about where the cow came from.
We have a quick fade from this to Rolf, who is performing the Moonlight Sonata. Pete.
Yes.
Do you think the Moonlight Sonata
Oof.
Is our earliest piece of classical music?
I'm still going to say no.
Correct, because it is also by Ludwig van Beethoven. Yep. It was first published in 1802.
Okay.
And our earliest date from a future episode is 1723. This is a weirdly abstract and...
If you don't know that this is the Moonlight Sonata, this isn't a joke.
Yeah, and what even happens in the sketch is a strange construction that I suspect you and Scott Aukerman would say isn't a joke.
Yeah, absolutely not.
So describe to our listener what happens.
Rolf is playing the Moonlight Sonata, a moon rises and goes away, and Rolf finishes the song.
Ah, see, this was what happens when you don't know what the song actually is. As the moon rises,
mm-hmm.
Rolf's hand also starts going up in scales, and he starts staring at it like he doesn't understand what it's doing.
Oh,
as the moon climbs higher in the sky, the scale that he's playing in also gets higher and higher and higher.
I did note that it got higher than it probably should have.
Oh, it's not even the piece at that point.
Okay.
And then once the moon has gone so high that it's no longer on screen and his hand starts creeping back down the scales, mm-hmm. that's also not in the piece. And then when he finally gets control of his hand and finishes off with a couple of finishing chords, that's also not in the piece.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. See, none of that meant anything to me. As I said, I know the Moonlight Sonata.
You know the opening.
Yeah, true. But even then, if I didn't have the fandom page telling me that this was the Moonlight Sonata, I would just be like, what is this?
So the connection between the moon and the Moonlight Sonata wouldn't have been readily apparent to you.
No, because I would have been like, I know this piece of music. That would have been the end of it. I would not have been able to go, oh, that's the Moonlight Sonata. I would just been like, yeah, this is familiar.
So the essential conceptual construction of this, that the title of the thing is affecting the music that it inspired.
Yeah. In the thesis of this show,
mm-hmm.
this does not work 45 years later with the current audience.
Do you think it worked in 1978?
People listened to the radio back then. There wasn't Miley Cyrus. Yes, this of course was a hilarious joke, I'm sure.
I don't think so. I think the weirdness of it is, as I said, very abstract.
Mm-hmm.
It's not ever given any tools to the audience, except for Rolf's facial expression of dismay and confusion, that he doesn't know what's going on, that might make an audience feel more at ease when they don't know what's going on. I think this probably lost a great number of people.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that it wasn't the UK spot kind of blows my mind. It is too short to be a UK spot. That's really, I think, the only reason why it wasn't audience optional.
Yeah, it's 0.87 minutes long. It's 52 seconds long.
After that, we go to the equivalent of a talk spot, in that we have Kermit and our special guest leaning on a wall talking.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, the set is completely different.
The fandom page does list it as a talk spot.
Oh, interesting.
But yeah, I agree with you. It's only technically a talk spot.
Kermit starts off the conversation by saying, "It's great to have a chance to talk quietly with you for a minute." Julie responds, "It is. You know, there's something I was going to ask you," and then everything goes doolally.
Yep. Scooter interrupts them first, telling Kermit that Robin fell into a tuba, but it's okay because Animal is going to get him out. At that moment, a tuba sounds and Robin comes flying into the frame
with a wee!
Landing behind the wall.
This is, unfortunately, I think, Julie's worst delivered line in the whole episode.
Hey, Robin, are you all right?
She tries mightily to pull it off, but it is her astonishment definitely gives the lie to her. I think she's probably trying to smother laughter.
That I'm also wondering if maybe she was playing it more of she's mad at him. Like, she's asking because she needs to, but she's upset that it interrupted what she wanted to ask Kermit.
Okay.
I have no evidence for that. It's not wild speculation, because I did, in my research on Julie Andrews, find out that she really gets into character. For the stage performance of My Fair Lady, the director had a 48-hour long rehearsal session with her.
Wow.
Where he really, like, they were in character. She was in character for that whole 48 hours to make it become truly natural to her.
It sounds like you were really impressed by this.
Yeah.
So it's beguiled speculation?
I was going to go with mild speculation. Yes, that was all leading up to me doing mild speculation, Ben.
After the unfortunately not quite up to par Julie Andrews line delivery, Robin says, "Yeah, it's fun," and scampers off to apparently get back in the tuba.
Mm-hmm.
At which point Kermit says, "Julie, you were saying," and then Fozzie interrupts to say, "I'm sorry, Kermit, did you want to see the Flying Zucchini Brothers?"
Now, Ben, historically, you know that I have issues with, like, Muppets we don't normally see being in back-to-back episodes. I'm like, well, why do this now?
Right. So we've had the Flying Zucchini Brothers do an audition in the Steve Martin episode.
Yeah.
And, of course, that was chaotic, and so it's, you can create a headcanon where they haven't
Headcanon,
yes. Where they still hadn't done an official successful audition for Kermit by the end of that episode.
Except last week they were in the episode.
Correct. But they were there because it was a benefit
mm-hmm.
that had been scheduled by Bob Hope to appear simultaneously on The Muppet Show without the Muppets really being aware of it.
Yes.
So they crashed the stage.
Yeah.
So I think it's still possible that Kermit hasn't really seen them do their stuff legitimately.
Ultimately, what I'm getting at, though,
is you like it when there's a little bit of breathing room between when characters reoccur.
Yes. However, I love the Flying Zucchini Brothers. And if they were on every week's episode saying Booma Booma, I would be totally for it. So they can come back every week for all I care.
Fozzie then says, I'll tell them that it's not a good time to audition. But as he goes off stage, there's a boom and they fly across the stage. Then a second as they fly back the other direction.
Yeah. Are there two brothers? Because it's the same one going back and forth.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Because the helmet is in the first one on the right side of the screen.
Okay.
And so it flies left to right. And then when it flies back, it's the same Muppet going right to left because the helmet is still on the right side.
Well, I think it's clear that the Flying Zucchini Brothers are so ballistically precise that the first one fired the Zucchini Brother into the cannon on the opposite
fired
side.
It
yeah,
back. Yeah,
that's their trick.
That's true, because we do also know there are three Flying Zucchini Brothers.
Yep.
So one on each cannon and one going back and forth.
That's right.
Because otherwise, with how many times a Zucchini Brother flies across the stage, mm-hmm. there are not eight different Zucchini Brothers.
I think the math checks out. So we have Zucchini Brothers being fired back and forth. We have Robin being blatted out of a tuba. And then Gonzo shows up to say, Kermit, Thog and Sweetums are playing badminton.
With his chicken.
And so in addition to the blats and the pows and the zooms, we now also have a bawk as the chicken arcs across the stage in front of Julie and Kermit standing at the wall.
Yeah, I wrote, it's just a constant stream of chicken volleying, Robin tubaing, and human cannonballing as everyone follows the action back and forth. Ben, did you catch the gaffe in this segment?
Maybe.
One of the Robin tubas, he doesn't make it over the wall. He falls in front of the wall.
And then pops up behind the wall. Yeah, I remember that from way back in college. I remember seeing that and being like,
But this must have been so much fun for them to do, mm-hmm. because it's clear that they're just playing catch with a chicken. Like, they're just tossing that, two of the performers are tossing that chicken back and forth. The Zucchini Brother must be on a string, mm-hmm. and they're just pulling that back and forth. And
there's also
Robin.
Another gaffe.
Is there?
On the DVDs,
mm-hmm.
after a couple of volleys and a couple of explosions, and Fozzie yells out, foul.
Yes.
Which is a joke about both badminton and the fact that it's a chicken.
Yeah.
The DVD subtitles say, in square brackets, monster:foul. So they think it's Thog or Sweetums that's yelling that.
Or we just established that Fozzie's not a real bear. Maybe he's a monster.
No, Pete. Fozzie is the doctor. The monster
was the mother.
Is Fozzie's monster.
Now, Ben, before we started recording,
yeah.
I gave a little bit of a hint that there's not that many things to keep statistics on this episode. Mm. But there is something to keep statistics on. How many things are thrown across the stage, whether it's chicken, Robin, or...
Peter.
Yes.
Surely every time that chicken is hit with the racket in order to volley it across the screen, even though we don't see those hits, because they happen off on the edge of the screen, even though we see the force of those hits, you're not counting them.
No, because it's sports. It's not malicious.
Gonzo is upset that they are doing this to his chicken. This is malicious.
Well,
do you have how many volleys? You said you have the count of all the things going back and forth.
I have the total number of things.
You don't have them differentiated.
No, I was so many things were happening that I was just going up one.
What's the point of keeping statistics if now when we get to the end they're going to know that there was an indeterminate number of hits?
Fine, before the end of the season, I will update just chicken hits. I will add that to the final tally. Not by the end of this episode, because I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to stop our recording. But there are 23 things flying across the stage at various points during this.
Well, there are three things flying across the stage at some point during this.
23 times three things fly across the stage, yes. It's so much fun.
It's so much fun. It's an absolute delight. And as it ends, the punchline is the question that Julie was going to ask at the very beginning was, what do you guys do for fun around here? And Kermit says, oh, nothing much, as they all watch the action go back and forth like a tennis match.
I'm going to be honest. I forgot that was the punchline. I forgot that it was even said. I forgot that she said that she had a question.
Yeah, it's a payoff. It's both so good because you're caught up in all the action, but also they fulfilled the premise of the sketch.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Excellent.
It might be one of the best things the Muppets have ever written and produced. Mm-hmm. I think that's what's key. The sound of it, of the boot, it's musical, it's well patterned, it's rhythmic, it's a delight.
Even though it has potentially a bad line reading, and other than that, she really doesn't have anything to do in this sketch.
Well, she has to react appropriately, and yeah. She does.
But yeah, it's great.
Sorry, going back for a second.
Yeah.
Scooter comes on to say, Kermit, I have to interrupt your moment with our guest star to let you know that your nephew has fallen into a tuba, but it's all right. He comes in to say, everything's fine. Sorry to interrupt. Everything's great.
Well, everything's fine because animal. Oh, yeah. Okay. I see where you're going with this. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt. There's a circumstance that's bad, but it's already being taken care of. So I didn't need to tell you anything.
But he would have because Robin enters through. So otherwise, they would have just heard a tuba and Robin would have entered.
Yeah.
So he had to pre-warn them, hey, you might get hit by Robin.
I'm just saying, the way in which he delivers that line is, get nervous about something that's going to be fine.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. We then, speaking of fake outs, kind of, get faked out by there being maybe an At the Dance. You hear the At the Dance music. There are some couples dancing. No Pogo George. Very mad about that.
I was wondering whether or not you got successfully tricked into thinking this was going to be an At the Dance. Because upon watching it the second time, two additional things jumped out at me to the first thing I definitely noticed.
Mm-hmm.
The two things I didn't notice is that the tea music, as it's called, that is the theme to At the Dance, is sped up slightly in order to get it recognizable before then getting it out of the way and moving into the actual song. The
background is different.
I didn't really figure out what was going on with the I first wrote down was that it's an up angle so that you can see the ceiling in a strange way that isn't a common angle for At the Dance. But actually, watching it again, I realized what was going on. They don't have what they normally have, which is, this is what I definitely noticed the first time, a chandelier in the middle.
Yeah.
They have a backdrop that is forced perspective to make it look like there's a roof. That's what creates the illusion of it being a strange up angle. It's just a really bad forced perspective of a painting of a ceiling behind them.
I'm looking at a screenshot from it, and I can tell that now. I don't think I noticed it in any of the times I watched this. But yeah, we see people dancing, and then Gonzo is standing in the background by himself, and then he starts singing a song.
The song is Won't Somebody Dance With Me by Lindsay DePaul. A song that she released in 1973. Lindsay DePaul in the 70s dated actor James Coburn for about 4 years. And sometime in that relationship was when Jim shot the Muppet movie with Coburn in 1979. And then he appears in season 5. In between those two points, he spent Christmas with DePaul and Coburn in her house in London.
Wow.
I can't prove that this is the inciting incident for that long-term relationship, but it seems to be the thing that happened earliest of all the things that they did.
Mm-hmm.
Before casting Coburn, before befriending Coburn, before staying with them and then having Coburn come back to the Muppet Show, before all that, they took one of DePaul's hits that she performed on Top of the Pops in 75 and did it on The Muppet Show.
Ben, I find all of that information totally DePauling.
This is the first sad Gonzo that we've seen in a while.
Yeah, but as you mentioned, it's sped up, so it's sad, but it's not downtrodden.
That's right. He's not depressive, but he is lonely Gonzo, but at a high tempo.
Just someone to care, someone somewhere who will dance. dance with me.
So we have Goal singing, which Goals has said he doesn't think he's very good at.
I think this is fantastic.
And then after the end of the first verse and the chorus, we do at the dance jokes, except they're all people picking on Gonzo as he tries to cut in on the dancers there.
No one wants to let him cut in, but then Gonzo notices something off screen and then drags back on a chicken in a ball gown. And they dance together,
whirling about, arms outstretched, in a passionate, I don't know, pas de deux, until they spin around so much that they fall down to a traditional clatter.
It was a good song. The misdirect got me. But overall, this whole segment gets a failing grade because there's no Pogo George.
Because, as ever, your reasons for declaring something good or bad are totally ludicrous to everybody else.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me, though.
Then we have a fade to black at the end of that. And when we come back up to what I assume is the UK spot.
Yes.
We have the jug band performing Borneo by Walter Donaldson, a song that he composed in 1928. Walter Donaldson was a massively successful songwriter, more of a song, people wrote lyrics and he composed the music along to it. Wikipedia says that he wrote the music to over 600 songs. They then list 49 of them by title as an excerpt or a selection. Of those 49 listed songs, 15 of them have individual links to those songs, which includes Makin' Whoopee, My Blue Heaven, and Yes Sir, That's My Baby.
He says baby too.
He does. He does. Or his co-lyric writer does.
He writes baby too.
This is a comedy song. It's a novelty song because the basic premise is having sort of sound-alike puns to Borneo.
Yeah, comedy should be in quotes.
But this does strike me as, since it's so old, the kind of thing that Jim Henson found looking for comedy singles to do with Sam and Friends, and they would have run across this in whatever their college version of Dr. Demento was in 1963. And they found this and were like, oh yeah, that's cute. Let's keep that in mind.
Well, it should have stayed in the Sam and Friends times, because boy, did I hate this.
They attempt to zhuzh it up by having the various members of the jug band do fun things with their instruments. We have a lot of kazoo.
Yep.
The player who has the kazoo has it on a neck brace like it's Bob Dylan's harmonica, so that he can play his instrument and then switch to the mouth kazoo ready and waiting for him.
Now, Ben, on the DVDs, there's never any captions for music.
Correct.
On Disney Plus, there are captions for music.
Yes.
And they made some choices.
In terms of spelling out the lyrics?
In terms of the sound effects.
Oh.
So when the kazoo goes, it does brackets. Toots. When the jaw harp goes, it says brackets. Boings.
Nice, good I one. Approve.
Like it. However, here's the real criminal of the bunch. When the jug is played, it says brackets. Beatboxing.
Well, let's be honest. That is technically accurate, because
it's
the
jug.
Muppeteer,
there's no box
the
there.
Muppeteer is not blowing into a jug below stairs. He is just going,
yeah, but it still makes a jug noise somehow.
And he is doing the beatbox mime of a jug sound without actually blowing across the opening to a container. And so the captions are more accurate than you give them credit for. It's hilariously atemporal, but technically true.
Speaking of atemporal, this is some of the worst off-timed Muppet performances we've seen since season one. I think Brendan Gleeson at the end of Banshees of Inisherin could play the fiddle better than this fiddle player could.
Spoilers.
Yeah. It's still a good joke.
Well, yeah, I think they probably had a lot of fun filming this, conceiving of this, executing this. I think that fun is successfully conveyed on screen. I don't think it's funny.
Yes, I agree with the first thing. I think they had fun making it. I did not have fun watching it, and I don't think it was funny.
It's not a pass for me. I'm once again sorry to say I'm glad I wouldn't have seen this as a United States resident.
Yeah.
We have another dressing room sketch, and this is where we have Kermit talking with Julie successfully, finally, that yes. We're not being interrupted, and they're reminiscing about the time that they worked previously together. They bring up the fact that Julie has written some children's books in the past. I would like to mention that one of her children's books was incredibly formative to me. Hmm. She wrote under her birth name of Julie Edwards.
No, married name.
Oh, of course. All right, that makes much sense.
Yep.
Under that name, she wrote a wonderful elementary age chapter book called The Last of the Really Great Wang Doodles.
Hmm.
That is a book that structurally has a lot of things in common with A Wrinkle in Time, in terms of you start with a terrestrial encounter where you meet somebody who's very weird, and then you go to a magic place where rules don't quite work in order to save things and come back to reality. And it's all about the power of imagination. And it was incredibly important to me as an elementary school reader. I read it and reread it many, many times.
That's really interesting because I have a link in my brain to A Wrinkle in Time.
Mm.
The first time I read that was in fifth grade, I think.
Okay.
And in music class, while I was reading it, all I wanted to do was read that. But in music class, we were learning
songs from Sound of Music.
Yes. Specifically, Doe a Deer.
It's a great book. I don't know if it's in print.
It's a great title.
Yeah, it perfectly captures that elementary school, I'm interested in this because I don't know what that is, but those words are interesting and mm-hmm. fun. Thing that Dr. Seuss and Edward Lear and so many people did so well.
Julie and her daughter write children's books.
Yes.
To this day.
Yep. That line about writing children's books is basically just a plug because they don't talk about them and it's not relevant except for the fact to transition to the idea that Julie also writes music.
Mm-hmm.
So they're just bigging up her resume in the middle of this dialogue to then say she writes music, she wrote a song for Kermit and her to perform previously and now they're going to do it again.
It was performed on one of those specials that I talked about in the questions mm-hmm. called Julie, My Favorite Things.
Okay.
Which was a special that aired April 18th, 1975. From what I can tell, Julie Andrews and only one other human are in that special, Peter Sellers being the other one.
Huh.
And otherwise, it's basically a Muppet show. The Electric Mayhem perform a rendition of Susie Quattro's Your Mama Won't Like Me. Julie joins them towards the end of the song. I'm just reading from the fandom page, yeah. So I want to give that credit. Julie joins them toward the end of the song, dressed as a hippie and playing a tambourine. The hipster band stops playing and gives Julie the impression that she's a square. Dejectedly, she then walks off and joins Kermit and sings him the song she would later sing again in this episode, When You Were a Tadpole and I Was a Fish.
This is a strange, strange song.
Mm-hmm.
I don't wish to be overly critical of somebody whose writing I just praised, but it seems sort of half-baked conceptually.
Mm-hmm.
So to sing to a frog when you were a tadpole and when I was a fish, therefore when we were both tiny little forms of ourselves before we grew up into what we are now,
mm-hmm.
you can almost get away with that in another circumstance, except with two humans, one would assume they were both fish in their tiny fluid-encased a gill-breathing selves, unless you get into the strange awkwardness of what a tadpole looks like, and you're singing it to a man. And that's just creepy.
Well, now, technically, Ben, now that I think about this, we did all evolve from fish.
Yep. I think the idea of
I'm now when understanding I'm, that
when I am
more.
Fetal, when I am that small, and when I was pre-baby, you are effectively a fish. Or if you want to look at it evolutionarily speaking, that many, many eons ago in my earliest form of me, that's how long we've known each other.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of works as a metaphor, but really it just sort of comes across as a simplistic image that's not expanded upon in a successful way, because she doesn't build on it. It doesn't go anywhere from there. And as opposed to, say, the heartfelt and nice sentiment of we have always known each other and we will always find each other no matter what form we're in.
Opposite to Lonely Goat Herd.
Mm.
I was bored by this visually, but she does a very wonderful job emotionally connecting to Kermit, and she sings it very well.
Yeah.
But I was bored. I also want to give credit, Hal Shaper is also a co-writer of this song with Julie Andrews.
Okay.
Maybe it's Hal's fault. Maybe everything Julie wrote was great, and Hal really blew it.
Speaking of statistics, you may have been bored, but I spent most of the episode wondering when or if they were going to kiss.
Yes.
Because there is some real romantic chemistry in this. And a lot of it is because Kermit is sort of nuzzling against her shoulder as she sings to him, and he's just poking his little mouth towards her chin the whole time.
I definitely had that thought a few times, but also with this song specifically, I kind of got out of that and was like, oh, this is just deep, deep friendship love. There's nothing romantic here.
And I thought that therefore the way in which he sort of was nuzzling against her was in awkward contrast to the before we were babies, we had this connection.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think they don't actually have a human Muppet kiss by the end of the episode. So it was just a lot of tension with no payoff.
Yep. No kissing in this episode.
Deeply weird. After the song comes to its non-amorous conclusion, we have Sam's lecture series return, where we have the lectern and the curtains and the great seal of the eagle behind him.
Yep.
Now, I said at the end of the last time that this happened that I thought that was the last one.
Yes.
Despite the fact that I'd thought that there were three, I was like, I think this might be the last one. You know, I thought that there were three. Well, here we go. Here's the mystery third.
Yep. And you know why, Ben?
Why?
This was not shown on Nickelodeon.
Okay. But also, there's some production order weirdness here.
Oh.
So, in chapter 33 of Joseph Bailey's Memoirs of a Muppets Writer, he talks about the process that he went through in order to come up with these sketches in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
He talks about his writing process and how frustrated he was coming up with ideas. And then he finally comes up with the concept for this sketch. He gets it approved. And in his description in the chapter, they built the set, they filmed this segment, and it was so good that they kept the set so that he could write the other segments, where he then went on to write Naked, and then he went on to do the final segment where Sam just disassociates himself from the whole Muppet Show.
Yeah.
The disassociation third segment happened in production episode 205 in June 21st. The Beneath All Our Feathers and Fur, All Animals Are Naked happened in production episode 206 a week later. And this one, the one that Bailey claims happened first, they created the set for it, and therefore enabled the other ones to happen, is part of production 217, which filmed in November.
Yeah, it all checks out. I don't see any issues with these numbers.
We now have two anecdotes where Bailey says, I came up with this for this episode, production 217, and it then happened before things that happened in the first half of the season.
But as we talked about earlier, it seems like they filmed all of those at once or in quick succession, so they didn't have to break it down and rebuild the set. So this may have been filmed back in June, and they just went, oh, we know this is going to go here. Or we're going to back pocket this, and when we need a minute and a half, we'll just plug in. We've got all these things that we can just go, oh, here's a Pigs in Space, here's a whatever.
It is interesting, though, that for whatever reason, it seems like this sat on the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
And that there was something else that they were either running short on in this episode, or that they needed to swap out, and that was never seen. There was maybe something else in this episode, and that this segment, which they thought was ho-hum, but still not as good as the weird wipe of Sam just saying, I have nothing to say and I don't want to be part of the show, which is barely a sketch. And is yet the introduction to this set. Mm-hmm. They really released these in completely the wrong order.
Yeah.
And I think it's telling that the one that is most successful is the one that's on the album, where Beneath Our Clothes We're All Naked, is the one that was remembered. And that this one even wasn't broadcast on certain channels.
Yeah.
Any guesses to why this wasn't broadcast? We haven't talked about its content yet.
It might be too political. Mm. Even though it ends up being pro-endangered species, it starts off being very anti-environment.
The very fiber of our industrialization is under attack from a small, subversive group of namby-pamby conservationists.
So it may have been Nickelodeon not wanting to be, oh no, destroying the environment's good, unless it's my environment. It's very NIMBYism.
Yeah. The essential premise being that Sam declares a quite lengthy screed about how it's his duty to talk about industry and technology, and that these are the things that are most important in America, and that conservationism is terrible, and that the things that they're trying to protect are ridiculous. He has here a list in his hand, which is classic McCarthy, classic Nixon, mm-hmm. who, of course, is the main influence on Sam's delivery and his evolution in this part, this season of the show.
Yes.
And as he starts reading off the animals that conservationists would protect, it is the mountain lion, the alligator, or is it the crocodile?
He says alligator.
The coyote, the timber wolf, and the American bald eagle. Just hawing and scoffing at these other ones. He then gets that and he suddenly stops and says,
excuse me, this list is now inoperative.
That, according to Bailey, is a very specific word from the Nixon administration.
Okay.
That was used by Nixon's Watergate press secretary, Ronald Ziegler, to describe things that were being reported on. He would say, if they were irrelevant, he would use the inaccurate word inoperative. Hmm. And so Bailey worked that in here. And I thought that it was such a strange cap to the sketch. How is it inoperative? It doesn't work.
Yeah.
And so it rang tinnily to me, and to then find out that it was a political reference from 77, that at least made sense, that it would have worked for a certain contemporary adult audience,
mm-hmm.
but therefore it's a very weird punchline.
Yeah. I didn't love the punchline, because I also was like, that's not what that word means,
right?
But otherwise, I love Sam, so I'll take it. After Sam's screed, we go backstage again, and we see Gonzo
upset because the cow is gone.
Yeah, he brings in wheat instead of roses. Scooter tells him the cow is gone.
He then says, well, I guess I still have time to call a chicken.
Yeah.
This is where it all falls into place, because he has danced with the chicken.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that we had in the talk spot, my chicken is being used to play badminton. All of Gonzo's fixations are finally coming home to roost in this episode.
Ho ho. However,
yeah,
we're not done with Gonzo and the cow yet. So even though he seems to be done with the cow, he's not done with the cow yet.
Well, because he believes he's been stood up.
True.
Twice, because the cow has two pairs of legs.
But he referred to my chicken before he danced with the chicken. Yeah. This episode's just all over the place, timeline-wise.
Or Gonzo is just a mad player.
Yeah, true. Gonzo is ethically non-monogamous.
Mm.
Is there a way to do that as an animal joke? I don't think so. Ethically non-monogamous?
That's close. Definitely ending it with a question mark really brings it home.
Then, in 45 years, I'll have the perfect joke for this.
Mark your calendars, people. 45 years from today, we'll have a special episode of the broadcast where Pete has some alts for you. Yeah, so after Gonzo has just said, where's the cow? He leaves, and Kermit comes on and says, where's the cow? Scooter explains it to a second person by saying he finally found somebody who would do something with her. When Kermit asks who, he's informed the Swedish chef, and he gulps and rushes off towards the stage.
Cut to the Swedish Chef immediately. We don't even get an intro song.
No Swedish Chef music.
Because I don't think it's for a segment. I think the Swedish Chef is just doing this. I think he's just preparing this cow for whatever he wants to do to it, which becomes apparent very quickly because he's painted. He's holding a painter's palette, and the cow has white marks all over it where the different cuts of meat would be on a cow.
And Kermit rushes on and says, "What are you doing?" The Swedish Chef babbles. Kermit responds, "You can't do that." Despite earlier having been not really been able to understand what the chef is, in this case, either conceptually or accurately, he knows what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, "Scooter, would you erase that cow?"
Scooter then looks directly at camera again and says, "Erase the cow," and then steps close to the cow, and it looks like he starts to rub his face on the cow as the camera cuts away.
Which gives you an interesting possibility as to what Scooter's strange orange pink skin is made out of.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe he's a big eraser.
Then we go to Muppet Labs. We could have just been going whole cow with this. We could have been having the cow shunt from segment to segment over the whole course of this episode. But no, we have a totally unconnected Muppet Labs segment where Bunsen is excited to introduce their latest invention, which is ready for testing, he says, the Muppet Labs new hair-growing tonic.
Beaker is hesitant, as always, when being...
Although he's described by Bunsen as being willing and eager.
Yeah, he's clearly not. I was curious as to where this was going, because Beaker has hair, and this is hair-growing tonic. So I was like, well, Bunsen is bald.
I assume that might have been part of the initial concept of the joke,
yeah.
Is that if you've got Bunsen creating a hair tonic, instead of testing it on himself... who clearly needs it.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to test it on the person that doesn't need it at all.
But then it subverts that joke because I was expecting Beaker's hair to just start growing like Play-Doh spaghetti.
Mm-hmm.
But no, Beaker starts shaking and getting lower and lower and smoking a little bit. And then his hair shoots like a rocket straight off his head.
Well, it pops. It launches from his head with a non-metallic sprawling.
Yep.
And he's left there with a small round top to his cylindrical pate.
Yep, he now resembles Bunsen. Bunsen then corrects the name of the tonic to a hair-raising tonic instead of hair-growing tonic.
He's very pleased with himself for being able to rebrand this.
Mm-hmm. Didn't take him 45 years.
And then we go backstage. In order to continue the cow arc, where Scooter says, Kermit, he's found some guys who will finally get rid of the cow for you. And he is informed that it's the Flying Zucchini Brothers.
Yep, so I'm already on board. I love those guys, as I already said. The Zucchini Brothers enter and try and stuff Kermit into the cannon. The brothers realize their mistake, and Kermit says that while they try to load the cow into the cannon, he's going to introduce Julie Andrews. Which he then walks on stage, does with one line with nothing to note about.
Still, I would say, while you may love the Flying Zucchini Brothers,
uh-huh.
I can appreciate what Kermit would rather be doing the most boring introduction in the world rather than being accidentally shot out of a cannon.
True.
Or being witness to the explosive massacre of this cow.
I think I was commenting on the blasé nature of this introduction because we've already established they're such good friends, they have such history, that he walks on stage and goes,
"And now, ladies and gentlemen, once again, Miss Julie Andrews."
No
passion,
flourishes.
No verve.
Yeah, no, the wonderful, the wickedly talented Andrews Dazeem. And then we get the final Julie Andrews number.
And unfortunately, this doesn't feel like a finale once again.
Yep.
It checks the boxes of what we've been talking about in terms of it's a high production number. It is our guest star interacting with a great many Muppets. She's singing Whistle a Happy Tune from The King and I. She's doing it in a graveyard with gates surrounded by all the various Muppet monsters. And there's a dance where she is able to evade them and whistle and put up a brave act, but then she collapses and gives in, and then they reveal that they weren't threatening to her at all. But it lacks...
That all they wanted was an autograph.
Yeah. And then they do one more round of the chorus.
Mm-hmm.
But it lacks punch.
Yeah, this should have been the opening number, and Lonely Goat Herd should have been the closing number.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that also lacks punch, but it would have still have been a more successful closing number because it feels more up than this does.
Mm-hmm. And Kermit's in it, Gonzo's in it, you just have more in it. Yeah.
Unfortunately, the link in the beginning of well done chickens and pigs and cow is the perfect exit from Lonely Goat Herd and its production to have done well done monsters and horrors and murderers and cow wouldn't have worked.
No, that's true.
But I do think in terms of tone, to have your guest star be scared and then to be whistling instead of singing.
Whistling. She does a real bad job.
Yeah, but that's my point. It's not really showing her off to her strength. It's showing her uncertain, unsure, and doing something kind of weakly as opposed to really busting it out in a fun way.
Mm-hmm.
It really rings falsely in terms of a finale.
Absolutely. She does well. She plays the emotions correctly.
Yeah, she's acting the hell out of it.
Yeah. And I do like the juxtaposition of the lyrics of the song with the spooky setting, but it fails in most aspects.
It's unfortunate that this is the ending. Fortunately, there are two really great jokes to end this episode.
Yeah. Because as soon as this is done, Kermit outros the show, intros Julie Andrews for the last time, with more passion this time than he introed her just a few moments ago, saying that this episode has been a particularly moving experience.
She then comes out to say, I've had a super time on the show, but she just has one small problem. She seems to have lost her cow.
It should be around here somewhere.
And Kermit is instantly a stammering, nervous wreck.
And then immediately afterwards, we hear a cannon.
And Julie says, naturally enough, what was that? And Kermit just tries to say, good night, everybody. That's the end of the show. Everybody crashes on stage. And then they have, instead of cutting immediately to the orchestra, a lengthy bit of business of Julie asking questions and looking around and
Repeatedly demanding to know where her cow is.
Mm-hmm. They literally milk this joke.
Yeah.
And it's kind of fascinating that they're like, yeah, we don't want to cut away from this performance. We want Kermit's panic and Julie's legitimate irritation is what's going on with her cow to continue to sink in in order for us to really appreciate what a great payoff to a episode-long question of where'd this cow come from? To whom does this cow belong? We finally, much like with the badminton bit, we also have a very long-standing, finally, Julie gets to land the punchline.
The credits finally catch up. We do finally cut to the band.
Yeah.
But it's way deeper into the band performance than normal. And then instead of Statler and Waldorf, we have another surprise, as alluded to earlier. We cut to Gonzo in what appears to be a dapper magenta smoking jacket. And the cow is wearing a straw hat. And both of them are, I assume, under the same stars that Gonzo was performing under.
For Ina Klein and Doc Musique.
Yeah. And Gonzo asks the cow, want to go to a movie or grab a steak?
And then he realizes what he said and his eyes go wide. And it cuts to Zoot playing the final note.
Except it's not a final note. It's a moo. It's a moo, Mario.
Yep, they go out on a final note of music.
Very amusing.
Well, I figured it would be cowardly not to make that pun.
Ben, there have been so many puns this episode. You and I, we've got beef.
I don't know. I think people enjoyed having heard them.
Well, let's talk about statistics.
If you dare.
I'm more mad that you just have more than me. Because I'm just working with two that aren't coming to fruition, so...
Well, it's, you know, fruit of the bovine.
That was good, too. Cowtails. Anyway, I need to move on.
Please do.
So we had many, many nice things to say about Julie Andrews. We had some not nice things to say about Julie Andrews. So in accordance to all of that, I put her at 9.
Hmm.
I think it's great. I think she did a great job. She connected with Muppets very well. The segments that she's in that we didn't like are still impressive. They're just not that successful. Or, I don't like the song, but the thing is good. So, very good. I would watch this episode. I would watch her segments more than I'd watch other segments. So, I'm giving her a good rating of 9.
In the top 10.
Yep.
I think that's appropriate and impressive for how good of a performer she is.
Yes, exactly. I couldn't rate her higher than that, but I couldn't rate her lower than that because everything she did was successful. Or, yeah.
It was of good quality, even if it wasn't enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. And the lack of enjoyment was my own personal things, even though this is my own personal rankings. I was able to see past it. In terms of music, we have a new leader in the clubhouse.
Wow.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like there was a lot of music.
But as we mentioned earlier, like, I think I'm more surprised that the stuff that felt long was technically slightly shorter than we thought it was going to be.
Yeah, when I was summing everything up, I was shocked. I actually did my math twice to make sure that I didn't plug in a number wrong.
Were any of the songs longer than 3 minutes?
No.
But they were all longer than 2.5.
No.
Okay.
Only Lonely Goat Herd was longer than 2.5.
All right.
Song for Kermit was 2.42, and I Whistle a Happy Tune was 2.48. I even didn't consider the Moo music, so that's like a second. But yeah, it's both highest percentage and most amount of music. There was 14.84 minutes of music, which is 14 minutes, 51 seconds, for 56.17%. So much music. As for hits, I will get back to it, but at the beginning of recording time, there were 3 hits, no Muppet Kisses, no explosions. On screen.
So on the one hand, very minimal in terms of statistics of most of the stuff. But on the other hand, it's the most statistics in terms of music. It's now more than anything else.
Absolutely.
I will mention there is one other thing that you track. There's a Will You Get Outta Here in this episode. That he says to Fozzie.
Yeah, I think I forgot that I said I was going to track Will You Get Outta Here. Well, don't remember how many of those there used to be.
I bet a transcript search will help us in that regard.
Good call.
Well, let us conclude the episode with our 5 favorite moments of the show. I'm going to start off with the acknowledgement that I love the cow plotline in this so much, I could easily populate both my and your moments with elements lifted out of various aspects of the cow. But I'm going to start with Richard Hunt's line delivery of,
"What's a cow doing backstage? That cow right there!
Kermit, that's a cow!"
I mean, we talk a little bit about the idea of how Scooter is young, Scooter is a teen, and yet never in his skateboarding, in his innocence, in his paper route, in his various other things, nothing has been more effectively convincing of how young Scooter is than Richard Hunt having Scooter be so vulnerable and confused by going from "what cow, moo, Kermit, that's a cow." He's overwhelmed with the weirdness of the situation, and he's just all vulnerability. And Hunt does such a good job. It's such a strong laugh line for a dumb reversal of "where's the cow? Oh, there's the cow" is so lowbrow in terms of writing a laugh line. It's 100% the delivery and the timing that sells that.
And so we combine moments here. Immediately after that, when it cuts to that insert shot, when we have the cow's face and the timing of Scooter sidling up to the cow and then just going, "Who do you belong to?" In that same innocence of, "I don't know what to do here. Maybe the cow will answer me," is just as pitch perfect.
Yeah. And is that your second moment?
No. Okay. I just wanted to pile onto yours.
Fair.
Because I have so many other moments in this episode, too. For my first moment, our second moment, our second and a half moment, I want to go back and talk about "I Want to Dance with Somebody," not the name of the song.
"Won't Somebody Dance with Me?"
There we go. This isn't a funny moment. This is one of those I'm so impressed with the puppeteering moments.
Mm.
when Gonzo grabs the chicken and they're doing the spin, the way they puppeteered that spin, I believe they're spinning. Mm-hmm. Gonzo and the chicken both lean into the spin at one point. Like, oh, this is going too fast. I gotta lean into it to slow this down. And then they lean out back to speed it up. It's just so well done. It was true. I believed that
the physics of it.
Yeah, I've spun like that with people, and I've done those moves. So seeing it there, I was so impressed with how they were able to make that a true to life moment with
that. They recognized that that's what people do when they're spinning around, and whether it was one puppeteer with two arms or a pair of puppeteers, which sounds highly unlikely,
yep.
But they recreated the reality of that.
And I now, thinking that it must have been one puppeteer, the speed with which they were spinning, I doubly believe now the falling down later, because that puppeteer must have been, I assume it was Dave, very dizzy at that moment and been very happy to be like, okay, I can sit down now. This whole studio is spinning for me too.
For our middle moment, the centerpiece, I'm going to talk not about what one spins around, mm-hmm. but I'm going to talk about the moment I was just alluding to when I mentioned Kermit talking about the "Will you get out of here?" Mm-hmm. That is the capstone to Fozzie's chaotic failing to stop the Zucchini Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And as he rushes in to say,
Kermit, I was too late this year. Oh, never mind.
Yes, no, you were saying.
Oh, you see, they have two cameras.
Too late. The timing and delivery on that of Fozzie getting it wrong twice in a row. The snap, snap of boom, I got it wrong. Boom, I still got it wrong. Is so well timed and so well done. And Frank's delivery of the helplessness of the situation is mm-hmm. extraordinary.
I was going to mention that how well that worked for you compared to Scooter's, oh, nothing's actually wrong, but I'm going to tell you about it, is a fun comparison. Well, for our fourth moment, my final moment, I also want to talk about Frank.
Yeah.
Frank said something in the Sandy Eagle sketch, besides the very good I have here a list, that has been a Pete joke for probably 15 to 20 years, which is I have long joked that I want to name a daughter Verily.
Mm.
And I want her to be a cheerleader so people can cheer for her and say, yay, Verily. And Sam the Eagle says,
yay, Verily.
And I went, yep, that's a moment.
No notes.
Nope. No, Verily.
Well, my final moment, our final moment, is going to be equally short and sweet. Pete?
Yes.
I love that hat on that cow.
Yay, Verily.
The cow dressed up for the date. Earlier, Gonzo was depressed because the cow left. But you know what? The cow wanted to go on that date. Cow got dressed up. It's pretty great.
Gonzo was so happy with that date.
Mm.
But traditionally, cows jump over moons.
You really ran away with that, much like the dish ran away with the spoon.
I don't know any other references from that.
It's all right. Just say your battle cry.
Yay, Verily.
Spoon!
That's not my battle cry.
Your battle cry is not in the face, not in the face.
Absolutely. This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design, such as it is, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. Music in the episode comes from archive.org and archival Henson Associate clips of Silver and Cones, Yes, We Have No Bananas, under what we hope is transformative fair use, much as the Hensons did when they first broadcast to Sam and Friends.
You can find us at farstperspective.com and follow us on Twitter at @FirstNameBasis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan Emily and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic phenomena.
All excerpts in the podcast are used for the purposes of review. If there are things, dates, facts, names, cuts of beef, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect, please contact us via the website. We'll post it to our errata page on farstperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete. My co-host is Ben.
Whee!
And we'll see you next week when we discuss Season 2, Production Episode 19, guest starring Peter Sellers. Yay! Hey!